Kitty, Chapter 26. At some time in the distant past, long before the first magicians arrived in London, the great church of Westminster Abbey had exerted considerable power and influence on the surrounding town. Built over centuries by a dynasty of forgotten kings, the abbey and its grounds extended over a wide area, with a population of scholarly monks conducting its services, studying in its library and working in its fields. The main church rose more than 30 meters into the air, with snub-nosed towers rising at the west end and at the centre of the building, high above the sanctuary. The building was constructed of a strong white stone, which gradually became discoloured with the smoke and magical effusions emanating from the growing city. Years passed. The kings fell from power, to be replaced by a succession of parliaments, which met at Westminster Hall, not far from the abbey. The influence of the church slowly reduced, as did the waistlines of the surviving monks, who now fell on hard times. Many of the abbey outbuildings deteriorated, and only the cloisters, 4 broad enclosed walkways around a central open square of grass, remained in good condition. When Parliament was itself taken over by a new authority, a group of powerful magicians, who had little time for the traditions of the church, it seemed as if the ancient abbey itself might soon fall into ruin. But one tradition saved the building. The greatest leaders of the country, whether kings or parliamentary ministers, had long been buried in the abbey crypts. Countless tombs and memorials already clustered among the pillars of the nave, while the ground below was honeycombed with crypts and sepulchres. The magicians, who courted eternal renown as much as any king before them, decided to continue this practice. It became a matter of great honour for any individual to be interred within the church. The remaining monks were cast out, a small clergy installed to conduct occasional services, and the abbey survived into the modern age as little more than a gigantic tomb. Few commoners went there by day, and by night even its perimeter was shunned. It had an unhealthy reputation. Security on the building was, therefore, comparatively weak. There was really no likelihood of the company meeting any kind of guard when, at 11:30 precisely, the first of them arrived at the unlocked door of the cloister's outhouse and noiselessly slipped inside. Kitty had wanted to visit the abbey during its opening hours to do a proper reconnaissance and view the exterior of Gladstone's tomb, but Mr. Pennyfeather had forbidden her.
"We must arouse no suspicions,"
he said. In fact, Kitty need not have worried. Mr. Hopkins had been his normal, useful self during the course of that long and nervous day, rustling up numerous maps of the abbey and its environs. He showed them the layout of the transept, below which most of the tombs were hidden. He showed them the covered cloisters, where once the monks had sat to read, or in bad weather taken their constitutionals. He showed them the surrounding roads, highlighting guardhouses of the night police and known routes of the vigilance spheres. He pointed out the doors that would be unlocked, and suggested, in case of random patrols, that they assemble at the abbey one by one. It was all very well organized by Mr. Hopkins. "I only wish I had resilience like you," he said sadly. "Then I could take part in the mission myself." Mr. Pennyfeather was supervising Stanley, who was laboring under a box of weapons taken from the cellar.
"Now, now, Clem," he cried. "You have done your part. Leave the rest to us. We are the professionals at theft and stealth."
"Pardon me, sir," Kitty said. "Are you coming, too?" The old man's face mottled with fury.
"Of course! This will be the crowning moment of my life! How dare you suggest otherwise? You think I am too weak?"
"No, no, sir. Of course not." Kitty bent to the abbey maps again. A great expectancy and unease had stolen across the company that day. All of them, even the normally equable Anne, were tetchy and highly strung. During the morning the equipment was doled out, and each person prepared their kit in silence. When Kitty returned with the benefactor's gifts, Mr. Pennyfeather and Mr. Hopkins retired to the back room of the shop to study the incantations. The others prowled amongst the paints and easels, saying little. Anne prepared sandwiches for lunch. That afternoon, Kitty, Fred, Stanley, and Nick walked to the cellar to practice their skills. Fred and Stanley took turns throwing discs at a pitted beam, while Nick engaged Kitty in a mock knife fight. When they returned, they found Mr. Hopkins and Mr. Pennyfeather still locked in consultation. At 5:30, in a brittle atmosphere, Anne brought in trays of tea and almond biscuits. An hour later, Mr. Pennyfeather emerged from the back room. With great deliberation, he poured cold tea into a cup.
"We have deciphered the incantation," he said. "Now we are truly ready."
He raised the cup in a solemn toast.
"To whatever tonight may bring, we have righteousness on our side. Be confident and keen, my friends. If we are bold and do not falter, our lives will never be the same again."
He drank, clicked his cup back decisively on its saucer. The final discussions began. Kitty was the second of the company to enter the Abbey outhouse. Anne had preceded her less than a minute before. She stared into the darkness, hearing Anne's breathing close by.
"Shall we risk a light?"
she whispered.
"Pencil torch," Anne said. "I've got it."
A thin beam lit the wall opposite, then briefly Kitty's face. Kitty blinked and raised a hand.
"Keep it low," she said. "We don't know about windows."
Crouching down to the flagstoned floor, Anne swung the torch about her speculatively, casting fleeting light upon piles of paint pots, spades, garden forks, a shiny new lawnmower, and sundry other tools. Kitty shifted her rucksack from her back, plonked it down before her, and checked her watch.
"Next one's due," she said.
As if in answer, a faint scrabbling sounded somewhere outside, beyond the door. Anne turned off the torch. They crouched in darkness. The door was opened and closed, accompanied by a sound of heavy breathing. Air drifted briefly through the room, bringing with it a powerful waft of aftershave. Kitty relaxed.
"Hello, Fred," she said.
At 5-minute intervals, the remainder of the company arrived. Last to appear was Mr. Pennyfeather himself, already weary and out of breath. He gave a wheezed command.
"Frederick, Stanley, lanterns on! There are no windows in this room. We have nothing to be afraid of."
In the light of 2 powerful lanterns, the 6 of them stood revealed, all carrying rucksacks, all wearing black. Mr. Pennyfeather had even painted his stick black, too, and had muffled its tip with a plug of fabric. He leaned on it now, scanning the party one by one with slow deliberation, gathering his resources.
"Very well," he said at last. "Anne, headgear, please."
Dark woolen balaclavas were produced and distributed. Fred eyed his one distrustfully.
"I don't like these things," he growled. "They scratch."
Mr. Pennyfeather clicked his tongue impatiently.
"Black heads alone will not be sufficient tonight, Frederick. It is too important. Put it on. Right. Final check. Then cloisters. So, Nicholas, you have the casket with the hermetic mantle."
"I do."
"And the hammer with which to strike it?"
"That too."
"Frederick, you have the jemmy."
"Good."
"And your useful array of knives." "Excellent. Stanley, rope and compass. Kitty, sticking plaster, bandages and ointment." "Good, and I have the key to the tomb. As for weapons, we should all have at least 1 moolah glass and an elemental sphere of some description." "Very well."
He took a moment to regain his breath.
"A couple of things," he added, "before we go through. The weapons are only to be used in the last resort, if we are disturbed. Otherwise we must be subtle, unseen. If the door to the abbey is locked, we retreat. In the tomb itself, we locate the treasures. I will divide them out amongst you. Fill your bags and return the way we came. We will meet back in this room. If anything should go wrong, at the first opportunity, make your way to our cellar. Avoid the shop. If, for any reason, I am a casualty, Mr. Hopkins can advise you further. He will wait at Druid's Coffee House tomorrow afternoon. Any questions?" "No. Nicholas, if you would..."
At the end of the outhouse was a second door. Nick passed to it silently and pushed. It swung open. Beyond was the ink-blue darkness of the open air.
"We go,"
Mr. Pennyfeather said. This was the order they went in. Nick, followed by Kitty, then Fred, Anne, Stanley, and Mr. Pennyfeather bringing up the rear. With the silence of bats, they flitted through the cloisters, flecks of moving graininess against the wall of black. Faint slabs of lighter shade marked out the arched windows to their right, but the inner court of the cloisters was invisible to them. There was no moon to show the way. Their plimsolled feet scuffed the stone slabs with the gentle rustling of dead leaves nudged by the wind. Mr. Pennyfeather's stick, muffled at its padded tip, tapped along behind. Up ahead, Nick's covered lantern swung silently from its long chain, weaving its illumination close to the ground like a will-o'-the-wisp. He carried it low, below the level of the window-sills, for fear of watching eyes. Kitty counted the arches as she went. After the eighth grey slab, the guide-light darted to the right, round the corner of the cloisters. She ducked round too, and continued on without breaking stride, counting the arches again. One, two. The weight of her rucksack pressed against her back. She heard its contents shifting. She devoutly hoped the spheres were properly protected in their wrapping cloth. Four, five. Automatically she ran through the position of her other weapons. A knife in her belt, a throwing disc in her jacket. These gave her a much greater feeling of security than any magical weapon. They weren't tainted with the touch of demons. Six, seven. They were at the end of the northern side of the cloisters. The guide-light jerked and slowed. Kitty nearly ran up against Nick's back, but stopped herself in time. Behind, the rustling of feet continued for a moment, ceased. She sensed Nick turn his head. His voice carried in a half-whisper.
"Nave door. Now we'll see."
He raised the lantern, sweeping it in front of him for an instant. Kitty glimpsed the black surface of an ancient door, heavily pitted and studded with giant nails, their shadows leaping and rotating as the illumination passed. The light was lowered. Darkness, silence, a faint scrabbling. Kitty waited, fingers brushing against the pendant in her pocket. She imagined Nick's fingers running across the dark grain and the embedded nails, searching for the giant metal latch. She heard a slight scuffle, and the sounds of sustained and suppressed exertion, little gasps and curses from Nick, the rustling of his jacket. He was evidently in difficulties.
"Come on!"
A soft clink. Dim light spread across the flagstones. Nick had lowered the lantern to the floor and was wrestling, two-handed, with the latch. Close behind, almost directly in her ear, Kitty heard Fred let out a muttered imprecation. She realized that in her tension she was clamping her teeth together so hard that her jaw ached. Was the benefactor wrong? Was the door still locked? If so, they were stymied good and proper. It was their only way in, and the door could not be destroyed. They couldn't risk any kind of explosion. Something brushed past her. From the scent, she knew it to be Fred.
"Let me. Shift over."
More rustling as Nick stood aside. A short burst of scrabbling, then a grunt from Fred. A loud crack and thud followed instantly, together with a squeal of rusted hinges. Fred's voice held a note of satisfaction.
"I thought there was a problem. That wasn't even stiff."
He returned to his position in the line. Without further words, the company passed through the door and pulled it to behind them. With that, they were in the nave of Westminster Abbey. Nick adjusted the cover on his lantern, restricting it to the smallest of circular glows. They waited a few moments, allowing their eyes to adjust. The church was not entirely dark. Gradually, Kitty began to glimpse the ghostly shadows of great arched windows opposite them, running along the north wall of the nave. Their outlines grew stronger, lit from outside by distant lights, including passing cars. Strange figures were depicted on the window glass, but the light was not strong enough to see them clearly. No sound came from the roads beyond. She felt as if she were enclosed in a giant cocoon. Close beside her, Kitty made out a stone column, its upper regions lost in the arching shadows. Other pillars rose at intervals along the nave, surrounded near their bases by hulking patches of black, oddly proportioned and very numerous. The look of them gave her an aching feeling in her gut. They were all memorials and tombs. A subdued tapping suggested Mr. Pennyfeather was moving on. His words, though whispered from behind his balaclava, awoke a host of echoes that drifted sighing back and forth amongst the stones.
"Quickly, then. Follow me."
Across the open body of the nave, under the hidden roof, following the glowing light. Mr. Pennyfeather went first, as fast as he was able, the others crowding at his heels. Stanley dawdled to the left. As they passed a shapeless knot of blackness, he raised his lantern curiously, and let out a yell of fright. He jumped back, the swinging light sending shadows racing around them. Reverberations of his yell danced in their ears. Mr. Pennyfeather spun round. Kitty's knife leaped to her hand. Silver discs appeared in those of Fred and Nick.
"What is it?"
Kitty hissed, above the banging of her heart. A plaintive voice in the dark.
"Right beside us. There. A ghost." "Ghosts don't exist. Raise your lantern."
With obvious reluctance, Stanley obeyed. In his trembling light, a stone plinth was revealed, nestling in an alcove. It had an arch in its side, from which a skeleton had been carved, emerging, wreathed in shrouds and flourishing a spear.
"Oh,"
Stanley said in a small voice.
"It's a statue." "You idiot," Kitty whispered. "It's just someone's tomb. Could you have shouted any louder?"
"Come on."
Mr. Pennyfeather was already moving off.
"We're wasting time."
As they left the nave and rounded a wide pillar to enter the north transept, the number of visible memorials cluttering the aisles increased. Nick and Stanley raised their lanterns to shed light upon the tombs. It was somewhere here that Gladstone's was to be found. Many of the statues were life-size representations of the dead magicians. They sat in carved chairs, studying unrolled parchments. They stood heroically in long carved robes, their pale, sharp faces gazing sightlessly down upon the hurrying company. One carried a cage with a forlorn frog sitting within. This particular woman was depicted laughing. Despite her steely resolve, Kitty was unnerved. The sooner they left this place, the better.
"Here,"
Mr. Pennyfeather whispered. A modest statue in white marble, a man standing on a low, circular pedestal. His brow was furrowed, his face a model of stern preoccupation. He wore a flowing gown, and beneath it an old-fashioned suit with a high, starched collar. His hands were loosely clasped in front of him. On the pedestal was one word, engraved deeply in the marble. Gladstone. Something of the reputation of the name cast its power upon them. They held back from the statue, crowding close together at a respectful distance. Mr. Pennyfeather spoke softly.
"The key to the tomb is in my pocket. The entrance is on the pillar there. A small bronze door. Kitty, Anne, you have the sharpest eyes. Find the door and locate the keyhole. He suppressed a cough. "According to the records, it should be on the left-hand side."
Kitty and Anne rounded the statue and approached the pillar, Anne training her pencil torch on the stonework ahead. With careful steps, they walked around the column until the dull glint of metal showed within the light. They stepped close. The metal panel was small, only a meter and a half high, and narrow, too. It was entirely bare of ornament, except for a seam of tiny studs around its margins.
"Found it,"
Kitty whispered. A minuscule hole halfway up, on the left-hand edge. Anne held the torch close. The hole was plugged with cobwebs. Mr. Pennyfeather led the others over. They stood gathered beside the pillar.
"Nicholas,"
he said,
"get the mantle ready."
For perhaps 2 minutes, Kitty stood with them in the darkness, breathing steadily through the woolen fibres of her balaclava, waiting for Nick to prepare. Occasionally a muffled drone indicated the passage of a limousine somewhere out in Parliament Square. Otherwise all was still, except for the sound of Mr. Pennyfeather coughing quietly into his gloves. Nick cleared his throat.
"Ready?"
At that moment they heard the scream of sirens growing louder, then passing drearily over Westminster Bridge into the night. They faded. Finally Mr. Pennyfeather gave a brief nod.
"Now,"
he said,
"stand close, or the mantle will not protect you."
Neither Kitty nor the others needed to be told. They crowded close into a rough circle, inward-facing, their shoulders touching. In their midst, Nick held a neat ebony casket. With his other hand he flourished a small hammer. Mr. Pennyfeather nodded.
"I have the key here. The moment the mantle covers us, I will turn the key in the lock. When that happens, stand still, no matter what occurs."
Nick raised the hammer and brought it down sharply on the lid of the ebony casket. The lid broke in two. The precise crack it made echoed like a pistol shot. A stream of yellow particles flew upwards out of the casket, twirling and twinkling with their own light. They spiralled above the company to a height of perhaps 4 meters, then arched out and downwards like water from a fountain, hitting the stone floor and disappearing into it. Particles continued to rise from the box, loop up and rain down, forming a faint, glimmering canopy that sealed them in as if inside a dome. Mr. Pennyfeather held the tiny golden key. With great speed he reached out, taking care that his hand did not stray beyond the edge of the glittering dome, and inserted the key into the lock. He turned it, withdrew his hand fast as a rattlesnake. They waited. No one moved a muscle. The sides of Kitty's face were swathed in cold sweat. Soundlessly, the small bronze door swung inwards. Beyond was a black space, and out of this a glowing green bulb of light came slowly floating. As it drew level with the opening, it suddenly accelerated, expanding as it did so with a peculiarly repellent hiss. An instant later, a bright green cloud had erupted out across the transept, illuminating all the statues and memorials like a livid flame. The company cowered within their protective mantle as the pestilence burned the air about them, rising to half the height of the transept walls. They were safe, provided they did not stir outside the dome. Even so, a smell of such taint and decay drifted to their nostrils that they struggled not to gag.
"I hope,"
Mr. Pennyfeather gasped, as the green cloud raged back and forth,
"that the mantle's duration is longer than that of the pestilence. If not, Stanley, I fear the next skeletons you see will be our own."
It was very hot inside the mantle. Kitty felt her head beginning to swim. She bit her lip and tried to concentrate. Fainting now would certainly prove fatal. With surprising suddenness, the pestilence blew itself out. The green cloud seemed to implode, as if, lacking victims, it had been forced to consume its own essence. One moment the whole transept was aglow with its unhealthy light, the next it was sucked down into nothing, and the darkness had returned. A minute passed. Sweat dripped down Kitty's nose. No one moved a muscle. Then abruptly, Mr. Pennyfeather began to laugh. It was a high, almost hysterical sound that set Kitty's teeth on edge. It held a tone of exultation carried slightly beyond the normal bounds. Instinctively she jerked backwards, away from him, and stepped out of the mantle. She felt a tingle as she passed through the yellow canopy, then nothing. She looked about her for a minute, then took a deep breath.
"Well, the tomb's open," she said.